This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Brian Westbrook. Brian Westbrook, a triangle-based actor, is a recovering addict who has spent some of his time during this pandemic reaching out to help others. He says that one thing that is paramount to both theater and 12-step recovery is the power of story. Here's our conversation.
I was a theater kid in the sense that from a very early age, I had a great, great love of musical theater. That was certainly encouraged by my parents and family, but we didn't have theater that much. We had some summer theater growing up. I didn't actually do much of it because, for whatever reason, I was off doing other things. I think when I was a kid, and we had very, very little theater. I think we did two, maybe three plays when I was in high school. No musicals, but I quietly, on my own in my room, cultivated a very very deep, deep passion for musical theater from fifth grade. I very, very clearly remember the moment it happened was when I saw Little Shop of Horrors on TV in fifth grade.
I love Little Shop of Horrors. That would be, have you played that role? Have you played the role of Seymour?
No, I haven't. I have, I've played in The Pit. I have assistant directed it. I have done several numbers from it, but I've actually never been on stage in the production.
I'd love to see you in that production.
I'm ready.
Actually, I think you should just play all the parts because you just a one-man Little Shop of Horrors.
Well, in the original Broadway and off-Broadway production, most of the ensemble is played by one person. And so it's very gentleman's guide-like, somebody who's donning different costumes and very quickly changing. Most of the time when it's done now, it's expanded out. So you've got, you know, more people on stage, which is great. But I would love to play all the characters.
Yes. Something else I really do want to talk to you about is addiction and your road to recovery. A couple of years ago, Bo Clark, I interviewed him. A lot of you may remember Bo Clark. He was a member of the acting community here, the performing arts community. Wonderful actor. And he's moved. He moved to Utah to work at an addiction center, their recovery program there. Before he left, we spoke about his recovery journey, and he was so candid. And when I published that podcast, the response was unbelievable. In fact, I would say in the 87 podcast interviews I've done, that one received the biggest response because people were thankful that we were talking about it. So I do want to have this conversation with you. Talk to me a little about your journey with, and I don't even want to say addiction, I want to say recovery, because we talked a little bit about the fact that you're in 12-step recovery. You said it better than I do, but talk to me about your journey.
Yeah, sure. Well, I appreciate you and I applaud you for having the conversations too. I'm not surprised that you got that kind of reaction previously because it's something that's not talked about enough, you know, because the stigma is still out there. So I am currently in long-term recovery and 12-step recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. And addiction is part of that. So yeah, I'm in recovery, but I am an addict and an alcoholic. And I have been for as long as I can remember. But like with any other sort of health journeys, particularly mental health journeys or health issues that are not quite as understood as others, it's not a straight line, you know, to recovery. And it can be very, very bumpy. And for me, I started my sort of road recognizing that I had a problem and then starting to try and fix it way back in like 2007, 2008, when I was still living in Ohio and I was working for a theater company up there. And I just, was spiraling. And I had a support system there, but it wasn't a professional support system to, equipped to deal with addiction. And so, took some steps there, fell a couple back, moved to North Carolina, and did all right for a while, and then really kind of crashed and burned hardcore after I moved back. It was a big change, and I just didn't have the foundation that I needed and did not understand. Most importantly, I didn't understand addiction. I didn't understand what it was that my body, brain, and spirit was going through. And so then I really started to make serious strides and serious attempts around 2011. And that's when I found 12-step recovery and learned a lot more and learned, the truth, which is that it is a progressive disease and that untreated, that I was going to die. So the two things I had to know right away or as soon as possible was I had to know and believe that it was a progressive disease and that it was going to kill me. Then I had to know and believe that I didn't want to die, because alongside addiction comes a whole mountain of shame and maybe some co-diagnoses with mental health, which I certainly had, that can lead to suicidal ideation. And certainly, unfortunately, that's how this ends up for a lot of people. And so I think that's the first, that's the most important thing that you have to try and keep in mind. I know what I have to keep in mind is that it is a deadly, deadly disease. And I know that that I wouldn't be here if I hadn't treated it. So, yeah.
One of the things Bo and I spoke about in our podcast interview, talked about the different kind of addicts. And we talked about addictions specifically in the performing arts industry. And he drew this connection between addiction and actors, addiction and artists, because some of it was performance enhancing and that kind of thing. For you, was there a direct connection between performing and addiction?
I don't know that it's actually true that there is a sort of higher percentage of addiction in performing arts or whatever. I think maybe more noticed or seen, because obviously we know famous people, and that's where celebrity is and everything. But every industry, every career, every type of person is just as much of a chance of being affected by this disease, because it doesn't discriminate. I do think that being in the arts and in the performing arts, what that can do is it can heighten your sensitivity towards life and experiencing life wanting to get to different emotional highs and places and things like that. I can't say that I never went on stage drunk or high, but I did. It was not a common practice for me. I always took that, and I've always taken that part of what I do very seriously. But being in active addiction hindered my ability to actually take it as seriously as I wanted to, because it eats up time, it eats up resources, it eats up mental space, and all of those things. And even in recovery, I've had to make sure that my motivations for being on stage are what they need to be, that it's never about wanting to escape from my life, which is surely the motivation I had for a large part of my life, was going on and seeing that really believing that my only value in the world was on stage, that my only value that I was bringing to the world was in performing. Mm-hmm. And that was a dangerous, dangerous place to be, because you think rejection is bad for a healthy spiritual person. When that's your only value, when you feel like that's the only place that you have any value, it's absolutely devastating. So, one of the gifts of being in recovery is to realize where my value is really in the world. And that's part of it. It is part of how I think I make, I leave the world better than I found it and provide usefulness. But when I think about my life today, that is not where I place, my biggest value. Either it was in the relationships I have with my closest people. And frankly, the most important work that I'll ever do in my life is to stay sober and help other people get and stay sober. Far more important than any artistic value or anything else that I do in this world.
I love that you said that. And I'm hoping that this conversation and the conversation, you know, following up on the conversation I had with Bo, will really help people. May I ask, what age did you start drinking?
I actually didn't start really using substances, alcohol and drugs. I drank a little bit when I was in high school, and then a little bit at the beginning of college. It wasn't until about my sophomore year of college that my behavior became to be addictive behavior. I started to drink alcoholically, and the way you recognize that is when you start to see priorities in your life shift and consequences that start happening in your life that you can draw a direct line to the substance abuse. So that's when the addictive behavior began. So I guess I was about 21, 22.
Was alcohol a gateway to other drugs?
So I don't like the term gateway because people can become drug addicts without ever having a drink. People can drink all their lives without ever, you know, picking up a drug. And I've seen everything in between. I've got periods of addiction with different substances throughout my life. Alcohol was pretty much a through line all the way through, with only, you know, a couple maybe periods here and there where I wasn't drinking as much. But that was always, you know, what I would call my drug of choice, you know, for the majority of my life and behavior.
Being an actor, there's cast parties, people unwind by going to a bar after a show. How do you navigate that? And I guess for actors who are in that situation of feeling like they are an addict and then they don't know how to navigate these situations, can you speak to life on the other side, on the recovery side, how you navigate those situations?
Yeah, well, it's not always been easy, but when I think about it today, I don't think about it a lot today because I think the myth that I told myself for so long was that I wasn't me or I didn't have a life if I weren't doing a certain number of things. So that life sober just meant nothing, or these are just all these myths that that is just, it's addict thinking, and it's all designed in ways to sort of stay in addiction. For me, I talked about to people is I don't have a serious problem with being around alcohol, right? So like if I'm out to dinner with family or whatever and things, and they might have a drink. But I always, and this is my behavior, no one else is responsible for it. My danger situations are being around intoxicated people. So I always make sure that I'll avoid potential situations like that, or I'll leave situations like that. You know, being around really intoxicated people is like looking in a really twisted rearview mirror that does me no good. So I don't go to those situations. I also, and then even in recovery, the times that I have sort of like taken maybe a risk and like said, okay, well, let me go to this cast party or this thing or whatever. You know, I've just found that it's also like, I'm not missing much. I don't, you know, I'd prefer to be going somewhere else, you know, and maybe that's just me. I mean, I'm a fairly gregarious person, but I just haven't missed it all that much. And I also don't think that I've missed out on the relationships and building and forming the relationships and familial sense that you get in theater that I always had before. You know, I might have castmates that disagree with me, but I've always felt that I've been able to still establish even better relationships now that mean more and that are more lasting because they weren't greased up by alcohol or something else. You know, it was all about the experience of being in the space and doing the work together.
Bo talked about the people who enabled him, and the people who enabled him were not the people selling him drugs. The people who enabled him were his family members who were giving him a couch to sleep on or bailing him out. Mm-hmm. I would guess there are some people who have close family or friends who are addicts, who are watching this, and they love these people. They love their friends. They love their family so much. And they really don't know what to do. So I guess, can you talk first about the enablers? And second, what would you say to people who maybe have a family member or a friend who's going, who is an addict?
I'll just say that and this is just me. This is not any, you know, professional thing or anything I've actually even heard anywhere else. But I kind of take issue with the word enabler because I feel like it immediately sets up folks who are loved ones of people in recovery. It sets them up for as already failing, and they don't even know what they're doing. You know what I mean? I'm a freak about language too. So I don't know what the right word is for it. But the behavior that you're talking about is just natural, normal, human loving behavior, which is trying to love somebody the best that you can with the tools that you have at the moment. And just like the person in active addiction doesn't know enough about addiction, doesn't know yet that is a progressive disease that will eventually lead to death untreated. The people around them know even less about it because they haven't even experienced it. They're just seeing someone suffer. They're seeing someone that they love suffer. And so the behaviors that people refer to as an enabling, you know, which is the supporting and, you know, and bailing them out and all of those things, they're perfectly natural human responses to people you see that you love suffering. Now, that doesn't take away from the fact that it can prolong the active addiction, because I know that it would have taken me a lot longer to get sober if I had not had the privilege of experiencing my own consequences for my own behavior. And everyone has the right to experience their own consequences. And if you deny somebody the consequences of their behavior, then there's just no reason for that behavior to change. You know, the only time that we change, and this is not just addiction, this is just human behavior. We will not change any of our behaviors unless the pain of staying the same becomes too great. It's got to be uncomfortable to stay the same. So that's the way I'll say, you know, what I'll say about that. There's all sorts of navigating relationships. That's why there is all sorts of other recovery programs for people who are loved ones of people in addiction, or people who grew up with, you know, alcoholic family members and are still dealing with that as adults. There are all sorts of, you know, support groups and things out there for people like that. So, you know, I don't like giving advice, but if someone is out there, you know, that is seeing, you have a loved one that's going through it, just, you know, educate yourself. Read up as much as you can about addiction if you believe that's it, and just learn as much as you can and really, really focus on what your behavior is and what your motivations are and what your feelings are. One of the best pieces of advice that I got from a therapist when I was still in active addiction, and, you know, I'm very close with my family, and so my family was going through it too, and I remember a therapist, you know, talking to my parents at one point said, you know, when we're talking about this, just deal with the facts. Just deal with the facts and let's keep it at that level as much as possible so that you can, when you can, temper those emotions, which is really, really difficult when you love someone.
It is very difficult. And then the relationship changes as well. There's a lot of things I think we don't talk about as much as we should. Mental illness is one of those. I went through a period of my life where I was clinically depressed, and I had a partner at the time who took care of me. And he helped me get out of bed. He helped me go to class. He helped me do all the things that I was unable to do for myself. But the interesting part of it was, as I went through recovery, our relationship changed a lot. And I realized he loved the depressed person. He didn't love the strong, independent woman that I actually am, because he never knew me to be that way. And so it's really interesting too, how the relationships change and how it affects everybody around you, not just the person going through it.
And I'm sure we'll probably get to it, but the prime, you know, sort of directive of 12-step recovery, as far as I'm concerned, sort of where it started and everything, is connection with other people, you know. And the I wish I could remember the quote or an article that came out a couple of years ago that I saw that, like, you know, the most dangerous part of addiction is not the substance, it's the isolation. You know, the one thing that I think I've seen in every single person that I have witnessed and talked with and worked through getting sober with is that the progressive part of the disease is that you are get more and more isolated, and that's how it ends. And so it only makes sense that the antidote to that is connection with other people.
Connection.
Yeah.
So talk about the difficulty, the danger in experiencing social distance, physical isolation, physical distance from family, friends, the people you have these relationships with, and how that impacts being a recovering addict.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the touchstone, the hallmark of 12-step recovery is getting into rooms with people who have had similar experiences with you and talking about it, making those connections and telling each other stories about what it was like, you know, and what it's like now and what happened. And that, to begin with, above everything else that happened, was the scariest part of this pandemic, was immediately that lifeblood force of what we need as addicts to stay alive was ripped away from us. We're also very dramatic people, so we gnashed our teeth and wrung our hands a lot about it. Until somebody was just like, hey, we could do Zoom, which, you know, and of course we did, because like I said, this is a deadly disease. So I want to stay alive, so I got to treat my disease. So moving that online is not ideal, and it's certainly not the way that I want it to go forever. But I'll say two things. The other scariest part to me about this was the number of people that are out there that then all of the new folks who don't have a place to go, because it was such an important step for me, and I know it was for a lot of people, to physically walk into a room and sit down with other people and admit that I was struggling and then have them tell me their struggles. That's such a huge, important step. And you know, it's no surprise that the rates of addiction and the rates of addiction related deaths and things have all gone up, because we are forcibly isolated, you know, and it's a tragedy. There, people talk about the sort of silent pandemics and all these other sort of fallout things. There are lots of different, you know, impacts that this is having on our species that we won't fully understand for years to come. That being said, there are also really, you know, sort of things that I look at over this past year that I'm really proud of, that I'm really, that I was surprised by, the miracles that I've seen, and, you know, some of the innovative ways that people have really, really worked to get healthy and stay healthy in all regards. And so, you know, those are the things that I focus on. And I do, I just make sure that I'm keeping my health paramount first, and then making sure that my hand is out and ready to help wherever I can and however I can. That's just as much of a part of recovery is doing that.
And would you have anything you could share with the person who is at the beginning of their journey, or they haven't walked into that room yet and they're struggling alone at home? What do you say to them?
There are resources available. There are hotlines available. I've worked some of those hotlines and I've talked to plenty of people, so I know that people use them. And when people are at sort of their lowest and at that, you know, at that point where they're able to reach out for help, got to make sure that there's a place for them to go. And so there are resources online. That's the other thing that's sort of a miracle about this, is that there are now, like, at any moment of any 24-hour period, you can go online and get in a room with other addicts who are recovering all over the world, and connect in that way. And so in some ways that's a new experience, something that's going to be a net gain when we get out of this is connections that I know that I've made with people all over the place in recovery. So and I think just reach out. When you've got the impulse, when you receive and like feel the impulse that you're struggling and you're ready to wave the white flag, which is the most important thing any of us can do when we're struggling, is to pull out a white flag and say, I need help. I need help. Somebody help me. Just follow that notion. Follow that notion and seek help.
And you did, I will say, after that podcast with Beau, you did share a lot of resources with me. And I will repost those links when I repost this conversation as well, so people can find a place to start. When I was doing a little research into the 12-step program of recovery program, there were two words associated with it. There was sobriety. I understand that one. Mm-hmm. And serenity. So talk to me about the serenity aspect of this.
So I don't know if it started with 12 cup recovery, but the serenity prayer, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot, serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So I imagine that's the context when you probably saw it. When I think of serenity, I think of it, it's just the opposite of the chaos that was my life. And chaos is, a lot of times we'll use the word tornado of our past or whatever, that sort of chaos. One of the sort of epiphany, ray of light moments for me in recovery at one point early on was that I knew that the hallmark and the barometer of my recovery was a feeling of safety, just because of how terrified I had spent most of my life. And so feeling safe and serene, because those go hand in hand for me, that's how I know that it's working for me. That I feel safe in my skin, I feel safe in my world, I feel safe in my space. And because of that, I'm able to be serene and do that too. But I think that word probably came just as a antithetical to the way that life is for active addiction, which is just mired in chaos and destruction, all of that.
What has 2020 taught you about yourself and creativity?
I'm not going to give 2020 that power. I will say that in one of the things that I learned, like I talked about, staying involved and actually upping some involvement in my recovery practices over the past year has been amazingly important to me. But one of the other things that it's also reminded me of how foundational storytelling is to so much in life. But certainly, like I alluded to before, that's how 12-step recovery started, with sharing your struggles and stories with someone else and then making that connection with them. That is where the magic happens. There are 12 steps and there are all of these other things and everything, but that is where the magic happens. And that is the same. That's exactly what I miss and what is so vital and important about theater and about performing arts is sharing our human experience and the human condition, with each other to help and better understand not just each other, but ourselves. If you're able to go in there and take what you see from a well-told story and see where the overlap is with your life, or where there's no overlap with your life, and then become excited about learning other people's stories. Mm-hmm. Because it is exciting to know that there are other stories and that there are other ways of living and other perspectives. It's invigorating to know that and to learn those things. It's just another one of those things that in the absence, we have not had live theater, but we have not stopped storytelling. the stories that have come out of this past year and the way that we've told them to each other and the way that we've experienced them and the way that we've connected with each other, it is even more important and more vital. And so it certainly hasn't killed anything, but it just reminded me that we're just nothing without it. We really are. We are just nothing without it, because also without it, we end up in that isolation place that I talked about, that addiction will take people and will take any of us is to complete and total isolation. And biologically, physically, spiritually, we're just not built to live that way.
For me, theater is about building empathy. And I think when we share stories with one another and listen to the stories of other people, it teaches us empathy and it teaches us compassion. So thank you. And thank you for your candor.
Yeah. And I thank you again for it too. And I just want to say that, like, it's the anonymity with which I speak about 12-step recovery. And a lot of that is all still a result of the stigma that there is around addiction and mental health and all of these things that science hasn't been able to provide a solution for, that we've kind of had to go off on our own and with our own tribes figure out solutions for. So if you are struggling with addiction, or if you're out there and you're struggling with a loved one with addiction, first just try and get rid of that stigma that you've got attached to it and deal with the person and the spirit and the heart that's in front of you. Because it's an unfortunate barrier to recovery when we can't get past the shame of something like that.
Westbrook shared with me a list of resources and 12-step recovery programs, which I have included in the episode notes. If you or someone you care about is living with a substance use disorder, remember, addiction is a disease, and as with any chronic illness, finding the right treatment is the first step towards recovering. If you like what you've heard today, please subscribe to this podcast. Become a patron of this program by making a tax-deductible donation. Follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.